This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, this is Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're covering the latest from Syria, where there have been clashes between government forces and supporters of the former president Bashar al-Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. In a moment, fighting in Syria erupts between forces loyal to the country's new rulers and members of the Alawite minority. Also in the programme, an eyewitness account of Russian attacks on the Ukrainian coastal city of Odessa.
This is pretty bad. We're talking about 200 drones, about 100 rockets or so, and the Ukrainian armed forces were only able to shoot down a fraction of that. But the targets seem to have been critical infrastructure.
And will Poland move to introduce military training for all adult men to counter the perceived threat from Russia? That's all later in the programme. Syria has experienced its worst violence since the overthrow of President Assad last December. It began in the coastal province of Latakia, the heartland of the Alawite community, from whom the ousted president drew much of his support. There were clashes on Thursday between supporters of Mr. Assad and forces loyal to the transitional government of former Sunni jihadist leader Ahmed al-Sharaa. And those clashes were followed by the reported summary execution of more than 130 civilians from the minority Alawites. Footage released by rights groups showed bodies in civilian clothes piled in the yard of a house or beside the road. The transitional government has only said there were individual violations in the course of its military operation. The government of Damascus has been sending reinforcements from across the country, such as this security official, Abu Dahir.
We, the administration of general security in Aleppo Governorate, are heading to the coastal areas to defeat the remnants of al-Assad that targeted the brothers in the general security administration in Latakia Governorate.
And Jable is a city in Latakia province. It's on the coast, and in a village close to Jable is where Mohammed lives. We're not, at his request, using his family name. He's an Alawite, and as you hear, he says he's really quite scared right now.
I'm currently in an area just outside the city of Jable, in its countryside. Today, I saw a convoy of motorbikes driven by members from the Sunni community in Jable. I managed to identify them because Jable is such a small city that everyone knows each other's faces. These motorbikes were accompanied by a convoy of mostly four-wheel drive vehicles with number plates from Aleppo and Idlib. The people on the motorbikes were helping the people in the cars identify the Alawite houses in the area. You see, Jable is a diverse city with both Sunni and Alawite communities. I felt very scared. I feel that I don't know what I'm going to do. I've never carried arms in my life. I'm not afraid of death. I'm just afraid that my mum or my dad will be killed.
Well, I spoke earlier to a Syrian activist and also an Alawite in Latakia who didn't want us to use his name or his voice for fear of reprisal. So we've had to read out his answers. I asked him first to tell me about those who'd carried out the initial attack.
Those people were ex-servicemen in the army, and they were fired along with hundreds of thousands of other soldiers and officers. Some of those went to the mountains and refused to deal with the new regime or government. During this time, the government has acted in a very wrong way, let's say with the ethnic Alawite community, as it was the main supporter of the Assad regime. Most of the Alawites, due to their poverty, went to the army to earn a living.
Could I just interrupt? And before we get on to what you say is the persecution of the Alawite community since the overthrow of President Assad, to that clash on Thursday, and you said it involved on one side former soldiers, in President Assad's army, and on the other side, forces loyal to the transitional government. How did the clash break out? How did it start?
Many militants came down from the mountains to towns, to Kardahar, which is the stronghold of Assad, to Jebla city, about 30 kilometres from Latakia, and began shooting and killing government soldiers. And they took control of those cities, and they proclaimed war against the government, and began to liberate the coast area from the regime. When the clashes broke out yesterday, the insurgents caused many casualties amongst the transitional government soldiers, so that those people couldn't fight in the first stage of the fighting and couldn't overcome the ex-soldiers. So they went to other places, and I quote a local official within the transitional government who confesses there were some violations by people who are not militants.
But so there were reprisals against the Alawite community, you are saying, after these clashes?
Yeah, in fact, more than 100 people estimated were killed today.
When you say killed, how were they killed?
Filmed executions. I can send them to you. All filmed by human rights observatories.
So you're saying that there was the summary execution of Alawite civilians in reprisal for those clashes that took place on Thursday?
Exactly, yeah.
And where did these, what you say were executions, where did they take place?
They entered the villages, too many villages. The most famous genocide was committed in Al-Muqtariya village. About 30 people were killed. Families, father, mother, sons, daughters were killed by those people.
And what's the feeling now amongst the Alawite community in Latakia?
They are feeling so fearful. They are in a state of shock, in a state of horror. They don't know what to do. There is no government or state who is ready to help them, to protect them.
The words of a Syrian activist speaking to me from Latakia province in Syria. And Joshua Landis is a director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and a longtime Syria analyst. I asked him if he was surprised at the clashes and the ferocity of the reprisals.
You know, I'm not surprised. I didn't expect something of this magnitude, but it isn't surprising because tensions have been building over the last few months. And there's been a lot of summary justice. The Alawites have increasingly become anxious and fearful, and they're beginning to get organized a little bit. And the hashtag, for example, on all the social medias, people pass around photos of dead bodies and insults using Alawite genocide is become, and it's just created this great sense of fear.
But there clearly is a rump force of Assad loyalists still out there and ready to challenge the new transitional government.
Yes, and we saw that on Thursday when regime soldiers were ambushed and some 11 were killed. It was very bloody. The photos circulated around, and that caused this extraordinary sort of paroxysm of violence last night because the call went out to Aleppo province, the militias up in the north, the Turkish-backed militias, Idlib, and we saw photos, night photos of long convoys of trucks with Dushka machine guns on the back and so forth, people moving towards the coast, chanting anti-Alawite slogans and calling for jihad and revenge. And so this just took on a whole different color once that happened. And you know, it should be said that Ahmed Sharaa has done everything right up to now. That's the leader of Syria. He has called for transitional justice and so forth. But he didn't have the forces really to keep justice. The courts are not working because so many of the regime loyalists who were in those positions have been let go. And that's true for almost all government agencies. There's been a major purge going on, and that's increased these tensions because Alawites are being purged from many government jobs and salaries haven't been paid for the last 3 months. So people are very poor right across Syria. And there's a growing sense of malaise, hunger, and anger.
And you give credence, do you, to these reports that a large number of Alawite civilians were summarily executed?
Oh, yes, yes. You only have to look at the photos on Facebook and online. You see stacks of bodies in various villages. And my own wife called me this morning, and three of her cousins had their houses, their apartments ransacked, two in Banyas, one in Latakia. These are big cities on the coast. Their cars were stolen and all their jewelry, their phones, everything. They were just glad to be alive. And other friends have written to me and said their parents' apartment was requisitioned and taken. Their parents are now on the street and have gone to neighbors. So there's been widespread looting and anger by these many militias that are not directly under the government control. So this really got out of hand and people went through carrying out summary justice.
I mean, you say the leader of the transitional government has got it right, but clearly not right enough. What does he now have to do, in your view, to stabilise the situation, to reassure the Alawite population and indeed rein in these jihadist militias?
Well, he needs to address the whole nation and he needs to address the Alawites directly. And it's something he has not done. He has talked about including all elements of the country. But he's referenced Christians, Kurds, Druze, but he hasn't talked about the Alawites really. And he hasn't directed his words to them. And he hasn't really spoken publicly on how this transitional justice is going to take place. There's no list of names of who's guilty and who's not guilty. So when soldiers go into towns, everybody gets frightened because they don't know who they're looking for, if there's going to be any kind of investigation or if it's just going to be summary justice. He needs to reassure the nation that this is not going to happen again and that regime soldiers that try to take revenge will be caught and will be tried, but that they that there isn't going to be this kind of summary executions.
And of course, this bloodletting makes it even less likely that international sanctions are going to be lifted against Syria.
That's true. And there, the, you know, word is that the Syrian policymakers in the White House are looking at Hayat Tahrir al-Sham as really an al-Qaeda branch. And Israel certainly has vocalized that. The Israeli foreign minister said just the other day that these are people are jihadists and that they're not to be trusted. So those voices are going to gain purchase in the international community because of this, you know, paroxysm of violence.
That was Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and a longtime Syria analyst. And since we recorded that interview with him, the Reuters news agency has been quoting the Syrian transitional leader as saying in his first comments since that violence in Latakia that his forces, and I quote, will pursue remnants of the Assad regime and bring them to trial. And the French news agency, AFP, quotes him as calling on Alawite insurgents to surrender before it's too late. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Poland, which shares a border with Ukraine and Russia, has been one of Ukraine's staunchest supporters since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. It's already far ahead on military expenditure, aiming to spend 4.7% of its GDP this year. And the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, has said that work is underway to make all adult men in the country undergo military training. And controversially, he's prepared to give his backing for Poland to withdraw from conventions that ban the use of anti-personnel landmines and cluster munitions. Wojciech Szybylski is with Visegrad Insight, a magazine in Poland. What does he make of this call to arms?
There are two reasons for his decision that has been announced in the Polish parliament. One decision is simply a strategic calculation. Poland is on the border with Russia and with Belarus. It's a frontline NATO state in a situation when Russia has already mobilized 1.3 million soldiers and it is capable of mobilizing even more. And we have ambiguity in terms of the position of US towards the future of support in Europe. Poland holds transatlantic links dear, but it needs to factor in every possibility. And it also wants to demonstrate its commitments both to Europe and to the transatlantic alliance, to the needs to defend eastern borders of our common western frontier. In order to do that, Poland, of all the countries that border with Russia, including Finland, the Baltic states, is the most populous. It has the biggest capacities to mobilize potentially a fighting force. And Donald Tusk is taking example from Ukraine, but also from a number of democratic, peaceful republics across Europe, to say that he wants every man in Poland to be having a basic military training. And if need be, if there is a situation that requires that, all of those people, all of men in Poland, are much easier to train for a specific combat mission, which is what has happened in Ukraine.
And that deterrence extends, according to Mr. Tusk, a plan to pursue the most advanced military capabilities, including nuclear and modern unconventional weapons.
In what he outlined in the parliamentary speech, he did mention that Poland is going to seek a withdrawal from, for instance, Ottawa Convention, which is about a use of, among others, landmines, simply because our adversaries are not shying away from using those. And those landmines are a practical tool of stopping an aggressor, as we have seen on the front lines of the battlefield of Ukraine. Without the ability to use them, without deploying at least potentially such minefields, the aggressor sees it as a weakness and is invited to step forward in their plans. When it comes to nuclear capabilities, this is primarily a discussion with France, which is open for coordinating or maybe discussing the rules of engagement. It has very strong ambiguity in its own nuclear doctrine. It's the only EU power with nuclear capabilities and the only next to UK in Europe within the NATO alliance that has such possibilities. Poland is actively seeking these options, but it's also signaling, again, this is strategic communication towards those partners who are not firmly standing behind NATO overall, which in this particular case means Donald Trump, and saying, because you create so much disturbance, we are seeking every option to secure ourselves while being loyal and good ally of NATO.
That was Wojciech Szybylski, political analyst with the Polish magazine Visegrad Insight. A Nigerian senator suspended from office for 6 months after she alleged the Senate president had sexually harassed her, has accused her colleagues of being complicit in a conspiracy of silence. Senator Natasha Akpoti-Uduang called on the federal government to investigate her claims against Senate President Godswill Akpabio, who represents the governing All Progressives Congress. I spoke to her a little earlier and asked how she felt after being censored by her colleagues.
I'm actually disappointed that in this day and age, the culture of silence in sexual harassment in Nigeria is still loud. And I am very disappointed that within 24 hours of laying my petition before the Senate president, whom I thought would have recused himself, you know, so he could face the Committee on Ethics and Privileges, the investigation, which I thought would be transparent, but I was just kicked out, almost like I did wrong by speaking my truth. I did wrong by speaking about the sexual harassment and all the malice that came after that, whereby my rights and privileges were denied bit by bit just because I refused to yield into the demands of the Senate President, His Excellency Godswill Akpabio. So yes, I feel very bad about it. But on the lighter side, I am quite happy with the public. They have identified the injustice that has been meted on me. I've met with my lawyers in the past few hours, and we are planning to go to court to challenge the suspension because it's illegal, it's unjust, and I don't think it will stand.
So do you still stand by your complaint of sexual harassment by the Senate President Godswill Akpabio, because he has said, he has denied the allegation and said, "At no time did I ever harass any woman. I was raised very well by my late single mother, and I have always upheld respect for women. I was even awarded the most gender-friendly governor in Nigeria."
I stand by my words. I stand by my truth. This man, the Senate president, has harassed me for over 1 year, sexually harassed me for over 1 year. Because I refuse to yield to his demands, he has continuously deprived me of my rights and privileges as a senator, leading on to my suspension. He is free to deny, but at this, that is why I call for a transparent investigation.
I mean, you petitioned the Senate against your suspension, and the Ethics Committee recommended that you were suspended, saying that you'd brought ridicule to the upper chamber of Nigeria's National Assembly.
Yes, I will say this, that the Nigerian Senate operates more like a cult. It operates more to protect the system. Even the oppositions, to a large extent, have been silenced. I'm a member of the opposition party. But there is this culture of harassment, of fear, of intimidation, of silence, whereby you see no evil, you speak no evil. Whoever dares the system is cut off. But I stand by my words. I am not a child. I'm 45 years old. And it took me a whole lot. I went through so much hurdles to emerge as a senator. But I say this, even though I am suspended, the Senate does not have the right to deny my legitimacy. I was elected by my people. I will not subject myself to such. Thank you.
Could I just ask, what does your case, in your opinion, tell you about Nigerian women in politics?
I'd say that I really feel pity for us. I feel that as the time went by, our voices get weaker. I feel that the women of Nigeria are pretty much scared of operating in the political spaces because the ecosystem works against us.
You're listening to NewsHour.
Hi, this is Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're covering the latest from Syria, where there have been clashes between government forces and supporters of the former president Bashar al-Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with NewsHour. Authorities in New Mexico have been giving an update on their investigation into the deaths of Hollywood actor Gene Hackman and his wife Betsy Arakawa. Their bodies were found at their home in New Mexico last week. We're joined now by the BBC's Regan Morris in Los Angeles. And Regan, just firstly, up until this point, what had been the speculation about how the two had met their deaths?
Well, there was, I mean, so much speculation. It was such an unusual case. They were found dead in separate areas of the home, and, you know, rumors were flying what possibly could have happened. One of their dogs died locked in a crate. Two other dogs were alive and roaming the house. The front door was open, and those dogs were alive and well. So it was something that was very confusing and caused a lot of speculation.
And we have now something rather more definitive.
Yeah, it's quite tragic, really. It's we've just watched the news conference with authorities in New Mexico, and the chief medical examiner who performed the autopsy says Gene Hackman died actually a week, likely a week after his wife. And they believe his wife, Betsy, died of hantavirus, which can have flu-like symptoms. They know this because they were looking at her phone, surveillance from her out in Santa Fe. She went to a farmer's market. She went to the pharmacy. She picked up the dog from the vet, which would probably explain why the dog was in a crate. The dog was recovering from some sort of medical treatment. And they believe she passed away on February 11th and that Gene Hackman probably died February 18th. And they said, you know, he had severe advanced Alzheimer's, heart disease. There was evidence of previous heart attacks. So it's really incredibly sad and tragic thinking what the last week of his life must have been like without his primary caregiver.
I mean, as you say, there he was alone without his wife and not really understanding what was going on.
Yeah, it's not clear if he tried to get help. It doesn't seem so, although they're still waiting for phone records. They said his Alzheimer's was really quite advanced and that there were indications that maybe he hadn't eaten for some time. So it's really not clear how he was surviving and what kind of condition he was in. But yeah, it's quite gruesome. I think there's probably still going to be some details to come.
So not quite the end of the story, you're saying?
I guess not. I mean, we might, once they get the phone records, I suppose we'll know if he was trying to reach out for help and what kind of shape he was in. He was well enough to survive a week without her.
Reagan, look, many thanks for that. That was the BBC's Reagan Morris there in Los Angeles with the latest by investigators on the deaths of Hollywood actor Gene Hackman and his wife Betsy Araquil, whose bodies were found at their home in New Mexico last week. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Another day in President Trump's America, another barrage of disparate announcements, an offer to talk to Iran about its nuclear program, which was immediately rebuffed by Iran, and a threat to impose more sanctions on Russia unless a peace agreement is reached, which was followed soon after by this.
I'm finding it more difficult, frankly, to deal with Ukraine, and they don't have the cards. As you know, we're meeting in Saudi Arabia on sometime next week early, that in terms of getting a final settlement, it may be easier dealing with Russia, which is surprising because they have all the cards. I mean, and they're bombing the hell out of them right now. And I put a statement in, a very strong statement. Can't do that. Can't do that.
Mr. President.
We're trying to help them. And Ukraine has to get on the ball and get a job done.
Well, a short while ago, I spoke to the BBC's Nomi Iqbal in Washington. What are we to make of President Trump's current policy towards Russia?
It's really hard to get a sense of exactly where the president is with this. It's just another turnabout, really, for his management of the war in Ukraine. So he has been criticised, amongst many things, for not being tough enough with Russia, for basically putting all the pressure on Ukraine. And so when he posted up that he was considering, and key word there, considering, putting sanctions on Russia, that was seen as a sign of him acting tough. But then now in the Oval Office, he is saying basically that he's still got no confidence in the Ukrainian leadership. And he said something which just completely contradicted itself, saying his justification for why Russia is pounding Ukraine overnight is because they want the war to end, which didn't really make any sense. But his national security advisor, Mike Waltz, was also in the White House at that moment with Mr. Trump. And he basically said that the US is still going to engage in shuttle diplomacy. They're still going to have this meeting in Saudi Arabia next week. And also you've got the NATO Secretary General who is next week coming to speak with US officials.
So, I mean, where is this going? It's very difficult at the moment to understand what Mr. Trump's plan is for Ukraine, other than pressurizing President Zelensky.
That's it. That's what he really wants. What he wants is for Ukraine to sign this deal and not give those security assurances that Ukraine wants and for it to end. He clearly thinks that it's easier putting pressure on Ukraine than it is on Russia. Russia is already heavily sanctioned, remember. It's not really clear, even if he did sanction them, if Moscow would care that much. They've got this meeting now in Saudi Arabia next week, a very comfortable location for the Trump administration. He, you know, sees the Arab state as playing a major, being a major diplomatic player in all of this. So we'll see what happens next week, because they're saying that they want to discuss an initial ceasefire and then a framework for a longer agreement.
And Republican ranks still solidly behind Mr. Trump?
They very much are, to be honest. They've really coalesced around his policy. Even the Republicans that you imagine wouldn't do so, such as his Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who, you know, has been a long, he's sort of your traditional kind of neoconservative, and he's long been a supporter of Ukraine, but he is standing behind Donald Trump with this as well. You've got another Republican, Senator Lindsey Graham, who only a few weeks ago said that to President Zelensky, you're the ally I have been waiting for my whole life, and now he's standing behind Trump. So if there are any Republicans who do not agree with the way Donald Trump is managing it, we're not hearing from them.
That was the BBC's Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Well, amid the tentative and confusing US attempts to bring an end to the conflict in Ukraine, there's been no let-up in Russia's military bombardment, as we've just been hearing. Overnight, about 60 missiles and almost 200 drones hit what Moscow described as military industrial targets, what Ukraine said was entirely civilian, its energy infrastructure. It follows President Trump's decision to suspend military and intelligence assistance, but as a symbol of Europe's growing support for Ukraine, Ukrainian pilots have for the first time flown French Mirage jets as they tried to repel that Russian barrage. Michael Bosarku is a global affairs analyst and non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank. He lives in Odessa. Firstly, my colleague Tim Franks asked him, what was his experience of this Russian aerial assault?
Well, as things go, this is pretty bad. We're talking about 200 drones, about 100 rockets or so. The Ukrainian armed forces were only able to shoot down a fraction of that. But here in Odessa, the targets seem to have been critical infrastructure. The private power producer here says that six pretty big energy assets have been hit here in the past 2.5 weeks. And it was the fourth night in a row that we've had attacks on energy infrastructure. Earlier today, about 100,000 people in Odessa were without power, but fortunately the temperatures have risen. So it isn't as bad as, say, last week when about the same number were out as well.
It's incredibly difficult for you to judge, I guess, but is there much talk about whether Ukraine is finding it more difficult to protect itself against this type of overnight barrage from Russia because of what's happening? I mean, especially in terms of presumably the Patriot missiles that may be used for some of those rockets, you know, that you've still got those, but in terms of intelligence, in terms of satellite coverage?
Oh, absolutely. It's more difficult. And for two reasons, really. One is, according to my contacts just outside of Kiev, who have very well-trained eyes, they're reporting that new types of drones are being sent over by Russia that fly up to 600 kilometers an hour, have a heavier payload of explosives, and hence require bigger rockets to shoot them down. The other thing that has happened here, yes, with the temporary, as we understand it, pause in U.S. intelligence sharing to the Ukrainians. So that includes, yes, eyes in the skies. So, you know, the Ukrainians don't have a blind spot when it comes to incoming rockets or drones. It helps them with detecting troop movements. And of course, it helps them to select targets deep inside Russia. And there's also signals interception that is part of that package. Now, I can tell you, being here in the very strategic port city of Odessa, hours, literally hours after that pause in intelligence sharing was announced, I walked along the Black Sea coast and could see a dramatic change in the defensive posture of the Ukrainians. All of the assets that were there, I can't go into too much detail, but all of the assets that were there, say, every half kilometer, completely gone. I'm also hearing from contacts who have been in contact with soldiers on the front line that they've noticed a difference already as well. So this is an absolutely worst-case scenario for ordinary people in Ukraine, because everyone here relied so much on that early advanced warning system that would be provided by U.S. intel of, you know, incoming drones and rockets to give people, of course, time to prepare and go to bomb shelters and whatnot.
2.5 weeks ago, I think it was, roughly, you spoke to NewsHour and you said, "I don't think in my 3 years in Odessa I've ever detected a darker mood." Given that you were saying that then, and that was before the US decided to stop sharing intelligence, how do you think things are right now?
Yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it, that it was that long ago. But yes, I just say darker. Because don't forget, there are a lot of people here who simply cannot move. Either they're elderly or they have businesses here or they just can't afford it. And, so there's not much they can do. But certainly the level of anxiety has risen quite a bit.
That was global affairs analyst Michael Buttercue speaking from the Ukrainian port city of Odessa. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour Live from the BBC. So President Trump has had another busy week. He addressed a joint session of the Houses of Congress, during which he again cast himself as the saviour of the American people. He suspended military and intelligence assistance to Ukraine as part of ongoing efforts to end the conflict, which has antagonised Europe. Confirmed trade tariffs on Canada and Mexico, which were subsequently watered down, and also confirmed that US officials have been in direct talks with Hamas over the release of Israeli hostages. And that's just this week for a US president elected on a campaign promise of America First, who since he's taken office has also had territorial designs on Panama, on Greenland and Canada. So let's take stock. Fareed Zakaria is a veteran politics and world affairs correspondent for CNN. What principles, if any, drive Mr. Trump's international agenda?
The core of it is Donald Trump doesn't really believe that the open international order created by the United States and its European allies after World War II is such a great system. And he thinks that the U.S. has been the kind of sucker in the system, forced to underwrite the costs of it and deprived of many of the benefits of it. And so Trump is trying to renegotiate the terms in which the United States has engaged with this world.
I mean, you attribute this world vision to Mr. Trump himself. Does he really hold these views personally, or is he being guided by ideologues?
I think he holds these views personally. If you go back to 1987, it's the first time he ever expressed political views. He took out a full-page ad in the New York Times. And the ad is basically a diatribe against free trade and how Japan has taken advantage of the United States and is going to dominate the world economy because of their unfair trade practices, and how Europeans have taken advantage of the United States because they free ride on America's security umbrella. So there you see the essence of Trump's worldview at a very early stage. Now, there are people who have a more ideologically coherent view of it. I would say J.D. Vance is really a kind of an old-fashioned isolationist. But at the core, these ideas that Trump has held are his own, and he's been very consistent about them.
And with his America First policy, that is in a long tradition of American foreign policy.
The piece of it that is a long tradition is the isolationism, yes. And America First is the term that came out of the 1930s for those people who didn't want America to enter the war, even after Germany had invaded Poland. The United States is a vast continental nation sheltered by two large oceans and two weak neighbors. And it's always thought it could get by itself. But ever since 1941, ever since Pearl Harbor, the United States has had, I would argue, a much more enlightened view of its role in the world and recognized that it could be the anchor of stability in a much more peaceful and stable world. It could help create a more open world economy, and in fact has managed to do so. But there is this older tradition of American isolationism that Trump harkens back to.
Mr. Trump clearly is very skeptical about multilateral institutions, if not vehemently opposed to them. What does he imagine in their place?
I think in Trump's worldview, you have a world of great powers that manage their own affairs, engage unilaterally with one another, cut deals. That's the way of the world, and all this, these international organizations and multilateral fora are just a lot of symbolic, you know, window dressing and feckless and meaningless. And, you know, there's some truth to that. There's, you know, the UN is a great talking shop. It isn't able to actually achieve much action. But if you think about the world Trump wants to go back to, this imagined 19th century world of great powers, it was a pretty bleak world for most of the countries and most of the people of the world. The aggression was common, territorial acquisition was common, and of course for the poor countries of the world, it was an age of colonialism because the great powers really did what they wanted to do, which was to rapaciously exploit. So as often is in the case when you have the sort of politics of nostalgia, it's an imagined version of the past that forgets all the bad things and remembers the enormous freedom of action that, say, Bismarck or Disraeli had.
So an isolationist at heart. So how do these plans to seize territory, such as Greenland, for instance, or even Canada, fit into that vision?
That's why it is not just pure isolationism. It's isolationism plus kind of 19th century realpolitik, in which your land acquisition was common. You know, there's a wonderful line from Thucydides, the great Greek historian, who says, "The strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must." And in Trump's worldview, the U.S. needs this territory, and Canada and Denmark and Greenland will just have to put up with American ambitions.
And how has he been able to explain this vision to his MAGA base?
America has oscillated between two traditions, one of saying we are too good for the world, so we cannot engage in it. And the other, which says we are so good for the world that we must transform it and make the world like us. You know, so the first is the isolationist tradition. The second is the kind of Wilsonian tradition of democratic evangelism. What has been a tougher tradition in the U.S. is to say the United States will engage with the world with all its flaws and incrementally try to improve it and nudge it along. And so Trump, in a way, is able to hearken back to that isolationist tradition of saying, we're not going to deal with all the mess of the world, the horrible UN and all these multilateral organizations. We're going to do what we need to do. But, you know, don't you dare threaten us. We'll come and beat you up.
I mean, I appreciate that his policies have proved to be very divisive in the United States. But is he perhaps tapping into also a weariness on the part of Americans at so many decades of being the world's policeman?
Yes, he's absolutely tapping into it. But I wouldn't exaggerate the degree to which he has tapped into some rich vein, you know, some gold mine. Trump won the last election by 1.5% of the popular vote. Donald Trump has had a very narrow victory. There are substantial numbers of people who agree with him, but there are substantial numbers of people in the United States who disagree with him vehemently.
World Affairs commentator for CNN, Fareed Zakaria, bringing to an end this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Hi, this is Rachel Wright from the Global News Podcast. We're covering the latest from Syria, where there have been clashes between government forces and supporters of the former president Bashar al-Assad. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.